October 25th, 1978. Las Vegas, Nevada. 6-year-old Carrie Sigg disappears from his schoolyard during lunchtime recess, and a student reports seeing Carrie being forced into a vehicle by a man. Hours later, the Sigg family receives a phone call from a kidnapper demanding a sizable ransom for Carrie's safe return, but the caller never makes contact with them again. A man named Jerry Burgess draws suspicion from the authorities when he keeps inserting himself into the investigation, and he is eventually charged with Carrie's kidnapping in 1981. However, Burgess winds up being acquitted of the kidnapping charge at his trial, and no trace of Carrie is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and on this episode, we're going to be covering an unsolved ransom kidnapping involving a 6-year-old child, the 1978 disappearance of Carrie Sigg. As you might know, this coming weekend, I'm going to be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon in Las Vegas, and per tradition, whenever I attend a podcasting event, I always like to cover an unsolved case from the host city on the very same week. I don't believe the kidnapping of Carrie Sigg has ever been covered on a true crime podcast, but it's a pretty bizarre and tragic story. Carrie's father was a wealthy businessman who ran a successful carpet business in Las Vegas, and he was actually facing some legal troubles at the time his son was kidnapped. The family received one phone call from a man who demanded a 6-figure ransom for Carrie's return, but even though he said he would call back in 2 days to provide instructions for how to deliver the money, the Saggs never heard from him again. A promising suspect named Jerry Burgess would soon pop up on the radar, as he inserted himself into the case by claiming he had been asked to act as an intermediary between the kidnappers and the family. Since Burgess had an extensive criminal history, this only made investigators suspect that he was either directly involved in Carrie's abduction or exploiting a grieving family for his personal gain. But even though Burgess was charged with kidnapping years later, he wound up being acquitted at trial. However, even though double jeopardy will prevent Burgess from ever being charged with Carrie's kidnapping again, he has technically not been charged with murder, and at one point, an elaborate FBI sting operation was launched in hopes that they could get Burgess to lead them to the location of Carrie's body. But the whole thing never panned out, and after 4 decades, Carrie is technically still a missing person, and we don't know the full truth about who was actually responsible for his kidnapping. So on this episode, we're going to explore all the different possibilities. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved kidnapping of Carrie Sigg. Our story begins in Las Vegas in 1978, and our central figure is 6-year-old Carrie Sigg, who lives with his parents, Saul and Marion Sigg, as well as a 13-year-old brother and 9-year-old sister. After emigrating to the United States from the Middle East, Saul Sigg struck it big when he opened a very successful floor-covering business called the Carpet Barn in 1971, which eventually made him a wealthy man. Carrie was born later that same year, but his birth was a very unusual one, as he had 3 extra toes on each of his feet, which would have to be removed by a surgery when he was only 3 months old and left him with permanent scarring. On Wednesday, October the 25th, Carey was just under 3 weeks shy of his 7th birthday and went to attend classes at the Albert Einstein Hebrew School, where he was a first grader. When lunchtime arrived, all the kids went outside for recess on the school playground from 12 o'clock to 12:30 p.m., but when recess ended, Carey did not return to class and could not be found anywhere. A 12-year-old student reported that during recess, he saw a man forcing Carey into a vehicle which was parked on school grounds. At least one source has reported that the vehicle was a Rolls-Royce, but I'll talk more about that detail later on. Well, later that afternoon, at around 3:30 p.m., a call came into the SAG residence, and the phone was answered by Geraldine Blutter, a neighbor who just happened to be visiting at that time. It seems likely that the male caller mistakenly assumed that Blutter was Marilyn SAG because he immediately said, quote, "I've got your kid," before demanding a large ransom for Carey's safe return. The caller told Blutter not to call the police and said that the ransom was to be paid in small, unmarked bills. He said he would call 2 days later with instructions for how to deliver the money before hanging up. Now, all of the initial reporting from that time period stated that the ransom was $500,000, but when the Las Vegas Review-Journal published a 40th anniversary article about the case in 2018, an FBI spokeswoman told them that the amount was actually $350,000. This is all just speculation on my part, but I have to wonder if perhaps the authorities intentionally released an incorrect amount to the media in order to help them weed out false tips from people claiming to be the kidnapper. Regardless, in spite of the caller's warnings not to involve the police, the FBI would become involved in the investigation with 50 agents working the case. Even though the kidnapper had stated that he would phone the SAGs 2 days after his original call in order to provide instructions for delivering the ransom, he never did, and the family did not hear from him again. The SAGs had chosen to withhold Carey's kidnapping from the media in hopes of negotiating his safe return, but after 5 days of no contact from the perpetrator, the story finally broke publicly in the newspapers on October the 30th, where Marilyn made an impassioned plea for the kidnapper to return her son unharmed. Believe it or not, the FBI did explore the possibility that Carey's kidnapping might have been an inside job, as Saul SAG had gotten himself into legal trouble 3 months earlier. After establishing a very successful carpet business, Saul was hoping to branch out into the gaming business, so he and two other associates, Jack Gordon and Joe Daly, had developed two new type of coin-operated gaming devices. They were hoping these devices would be implemented for use in the state's casinos, as they believed it could bring them over $100 million in profits. This would require the approval of the Nevada Gaming Control Board, but they recommended against the installation of these devices. Now, the Nevada Gaming Commission had the authority to override the board's recommendation and approve the usage of the devices in casinos, but while the commission voted 4-1 in favor of this, the vote would have to be unanimous for any change to be made. The story goes that Saul and his two associates approached the commission's chairman, Harry Reid, and offered him a bribe to influence the dissenting commission member and get him to change his vote. And yes, this is the same Harry Reid who later became a United States Senator and was the Senate Majority Leader from 2007 until 2015. Reid reported this incident to the FBI, who set up a sting operation where the men were videotaped delivering $12,000 in cash to Reid at his office. Afterward, Saul, Jack Gordon, and Joe Daly were arrested and charged with using interstate facilities to commit bribery before they were released on bond. Saul was scheduled to stand trial for the charge in federal court in December of that year, but the kidnapping of his son caused the trial to be delayed. Since it was believed that Saul's role in the bribery scandal was less substantial than his two co-conspirators, and Carey could not be recovered, a decision was made to drop the charges against Saul on compassionate grounds. Prosecutors believe that Saul's mental condition at the time made it impossible for him to stand trial, though Gordon and Daly would still be convicted on their charges and received 6-month prison sentences. Naturally, rumors did circulate that Saul might have orchestrated his own son's disappearance as a distraction in order to make his own legal troubles go away, but investigators found no evidence to support this, and ruled out everyone from the Sage family as suspects. By all accounts, Saul seemed genuinely distraught by his son's kidnapping and offered a $50,000 reward for information, while Marilyn consulted with some psychics in hopes of finding Carrie. Shortly after Carrie's abduction took place, a 41-year-old potential suspect popped up on the radar named Gerald Howard Burgess, who went by the name Jerry, and had worked as a bellman in various Las Vegas hotels. Burgess's girlfriend at the time, Stevie Paul, happened to be friends with Marilyn Sage, and Saul claimed that he first met Burgess when the couple showed up at his residence and Burgess tried to sell him some jewelry. However, it's also been reported that following Saul's indictment for bribery, Burgess had approached him and said he was willing to, quote-unquote, take care of Harry Reid to make the bribery charges go away, but Saul responded by throwing Burgess out of his house. It turned out that Burgess had a connection to the Albert Einstein Hebrew School, as he was dating a teacher who worked there, and he also sometimes did work around the school as a handyman. In fact, the teacher's son was also a student there and a friend of Carrie's. I will throw in a disclaimer that I can't officially confirm if Stevie Paul was the teacher who worked at the school, because Burgess reportedly had a number of different girlfriends during this time period, so this may be an entirely different woman. On the day Carrie was kidnapped, Saul claimed that he was contacted by Burgess later that evening, who told him that he had heard about what happened, and expressed his belief that the incident would reflect badly on the school, stating, quote, "I hate the rabbi, I hope this thing will destroy the school," end quote. According to Burgess, Saul asked him for help to find his son, and Burgess agreed to speak to some informants he knew on the Las Vegas Strip. The following day, Burgess visited the Sage residence and asked Saul if the ransom money had been assembled and where it was, and Saul told him it had been put together in $20 bills and was currently under guard at the Bingo Palace Casino. Later that evening, Burgess met up with Saul again and told him that he had essentially been performing his own independent investigation into Carrie's disappearance by, quote-unquote, working the streets, and he had just put out what he described as $1,000 in, quote-unquote, feeler money to informants he knew. As a result, Burgess asked Saul to reimburse him the money, and Saul actually complied and gave it to him. Well, the following day, Burgess phoned Saul and shared a surprising story. According to Burgess, he was continuing to, quote-unquote, work the streets to learn whatever he could about the kidnapping, but while walking down the Las Vegas Strip, he heard a nearby payphone ring. A stranger decided to answer it and yelled out, "Are you Jerry Burgess?" So Burgess grabbed the receiver. The caller then told Burgess that he was Carrie's kidnapper and wanted him to function as an intermediary during the ransom negotiations. The kidnapper said that he wanted a $25,000 down payment to be made in good faith and provided instructions for leaving the money under a garbage can. Burgess claimed that he complied with the kidnapper by leaving $25,000 of his own money at that spot for them, so he asked Saul if he could be reimbursed for it. Burgess said that he had been planning to use that money to put a $32,000 down payment on a house he was purchasing for his girlfriend, Stevie Paul, but she would lose the house if he did not pay that day. Burgess said Stevie would soon be showing up at the residence to collect the money, and sure enough, she arrived almost immediately after the call ended, and Saul agreed to give her a check for $32,000. Well, naturally, these actions aroused the suspicion of the FBI, who immediately took Burgess in for questioning and gave him a lengthy interview. But the answers Burgess provided to these questions were very evasive, and one FBI agent would later describe the interview as the most difficult he had ever conducted. But the situation with Burgess would grow even more bizarre. A short time after his interview, Burgess would contact Saul's attorney, Oscar Goodman, who was also a close friend of the Sages. Since Burgess had seemingly appointed himself to be the unofficial intermediary between the kidnappers and the family, he claimed that he received another phone call from the perpetrator, who told him that one of Carrie's shoes could be found in a desert area bordered by Desert Inn Road, Flamingo Road, and the Boulder Highway. When Goodman shared this information with the FBI, they would find a child's shoe at the location Burgess provided, and Marilyn would positively identify it as one of the shoes she had put on her son's feet when he went to school on the day he disappeared. Naturally, the FBI had come to suspect that Burgess was most likely involved in the kidnapping, as he had been seen on the grounds of the Albert Einstein Hebrew School during the time period Carrie was kidnapped, and the 12-year-old student who witnessed Carrie being forced into a vehicle identified Burgess as the man he was with. For his part, Burgess did not deny being at the school that day, but said that he had only stopped by to bring lunch for his girlfriend's son and had no involvement in Carrie's disappearance. However, after hearing Burgess's voice, Geraldine Blutter, the neighbor who answered the ransom call from the kidnapping at the Sage residence, was certain that Burgess had been the caller. Well, on December the 12th, less than 2 months after Carrie's abduction, Burgess would be arrested on the charges of rape and possessing a stolen pistol. By this point, the teacher whom Burgess had been dating came forward and told the authorities that 1 week before Carrie went missing, Burgess had showed up at the Albert Einstein Hebrew School and invited her to take a ride with him, but he then proceeded to drive her out into the desert and rape her. Burgess was released on bond for these charges, but only 1 day later, he was arrested again after a federal grand jury indicted him on the charge of interstate theft. Back in 1976, Burgess had been dating another woman with elderly parents who lived in Texas. He passed himself off as a representative of the Caesars Palace Hotel and Casino and told the couple that it was experiencing serious money problems, so they were reaching out to people for loans in order to get back on their feet. He said that if they were willing to loan Caesars Palace $100,000, the casino would repay it all back within 1 year at 25% interest, but the only condition was that they had to keep the loan secret. Well, the couple bought this story, and they actually traveled to Las Vegas with a large bag containing $100,000 in cash. Burgess met them at the airport and drove them to Caesar's Palace, where they witnessed him deposit their bag in the casino cage and receive a receipt for the transaction. Burgess then put the couple up in a comped room at the hotel, but what they didn't realize is that casino cages are only used as safety repositories for guests, so Burgess soon returned there and used the receipt to claim the bag before taking off with their $100,000. Burgess would ultimately receive a 15-year prison sentence for the rape, which was a state charge, and in addition to interstate theft, he was also charged with one count of tax evasion. Since these were both federal charges, Burgess was convicted of them in federal court and received separate 10 and 5-year sentences, which would be served concurrently with his sentence for rape. Burgess was subsequently sent to a federal prison in Pennsylvania, but while he was incarcerated, investigators continued to build up a case against him for his alleged role in Carrie Sage's disappearance. Well, in March of 1981, a Clark County grand jury finally indicted Burgess on the charges of first-degree kidnapping and obtaining money under false pretenses. As you recall, Burgess had coerced Saul Sage into giving him a large amount of money under the pretense of reimbursing him for paying off the so-called kidnappers, but this was not the only example of Burgess using this tactic. On November 16, 1978, Hank Greenspun, the publisher of the Las Vegas Sun newspaper, had written a column in which he personally offered a reward for Carrie's safe return with promises of anonymity. Well, Greenspun was soon contacted by Burgess, who told him that since he was functioning as an intermediary, he could deliver the reward money to the kidnappers and ensure Carrie's recovery. Well, the two men arranged a meeting where Greenspun handed over $154,000 of his own money to Burgess. When Greenspun told Burgess that he wanted him to go pick up the kid, Burgess replied, quote, "I understand the transportation of that person is being done right now." But surprise, surprise, after they parted ways, Greenspun did not hear from Burgess again and never recovered his money. But what Burgess did not realize is that Greenspun had been wearing a wire, and the recording of their conversation would be used as evidence at his kidnapping trial. Since it could not be proven that any state lines were crossed during Carrie's kidnapping, Burgess was indicted on state charges rather than federal charges, and the trial would take place in Clark County District Court. But since Carrie's body could still not be found, and there was no conclusive evidence to prove he was dead, Burgess was not charged with murder. When Geraldine Blutter was called upon to take the stand at trial, she testified that she recognized Burgess's voice as the caller who had phoned in the ransom demand. The playground supervisor at the Albert Einstein Hebrew School claimed that she had seen Burgess on the school grounds talking to Carrie on the day he went missing, and additional testimony was provided by a former business partner of Burgess, who reported seeing him inside a car with a child about a mile from the school on that particular day. However, the prosecution's case would receive a major blow when the student who had seen a man forcing Carrie into a vehicle was called to the stand. He testified that he knew Jerry Burgess because he worked as a handyman at the school, but when asked if Burgess was the man he saw with Carrie, the student surprised everyone by saying no. One of the defense's main strategies was to cast suspicion away from Burgess by alleging that Saul Sagg had arranged his own son's kidnapping in order to avoid going to trial for the bribery charges he was facing. Burgess even took the stand to testify on his own behalf, painting himself as a family friend who only kept interjecting himself into the investigation because he wanted to help get Carrie back. The trial lasted 3 weeks, and the jury would end up deliberating for 4 days, but they ultimately believed there was not enough evidence to prove Burgess's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. On February the 9th, 1982, the jury announced that they had found him not guilty on all charges. Following his acquittal, Burgess told the media that law enforcement considered him to be a quote-unquote handy suspect because they had been under immense pressure to solve the case. He also expressed his belief that Carrie was still alive and living in Israel, but did not provide any evidence to support this statement. Burgess was returned to federal prison to finish serving out his sentence on the federal charges, and after he was paroled in December of 1983, he was transferred to the Nevada prison system to serve out the remainder of his sentence for the rape before he was released in 1989. Burgess soon married a longtime girlfriend of his named Phyllis and moved back to Las Vegas. In 1996, Saul Sagg finally sold his carpet barn business, but his marriage to Marilyn ended in divorce 1 year later, and he would eventually face more legal trouble. In April of 1999, it was announced that Saul had fled the country in order to avoid paying over $6 million in gambling debts he had left behind. 2 years earlier, Saul had written out a series of bad checks to 3 Las Vegas casinos in order to pay off these debts, but all the checks bounced. When Saul skipped the country, a warrant was issued for his arrest on 6 felony counts, but Saul's attorneys were hoping they could negotiate a settlement with these casinos. 2 months after he fled, Saul returned to the U.S. and turned himself in. He agreed to plead guilty in district court to 1 felony charge of passing a bad check, but was told that if he paid back all the debts he owed within the next 2 years, the charge would be dismissed and he could avoid prison time. While all this was going on, the FBI decided to launch a new investigation into Jerry Burgess and his possible involvement in Carrie's disappearance, and this investigation would last 18 months. They orchestrated a sting operation involving an FBI informant named Franklin Perry, whom they agreed to release from jail on a previous fraud conviction. The plan was for Perry to approach Burgess to inform him that he and a business partner of his were involved in a $1 million deal involving Chinese bonds. Sometime thereafter, Perry told Burgess that he had killed his business partner's nephew after discovering that he was actually an undercover agent named Devin McGillicuddy, which is one of the most obviously fake-sounding names ever, but that's beside the point. Perry then displayed a photograph of Devin McGillicuddy's body inside the trunk of his car, but it was actually just an FBI agent pretending to be dead for the camera. This entire ruse was done for the purposes of allowing Perry to pick Burgess's brain about Carrie Sagg's disappearance, as he had told Perry he was involved in the boy's kidnapping and the disposal of his body. Burgess never actually made a direct confession to the crime, and he would often communicate in code by using words like puppies and Rottweilers as a substitute for bodies. He told Perry that he knew how to weld puppies and Rottweilers inside a steel drum filled with acid, and could get rid of it at a place where no one would ever find it. Now, I just want to provide an assurance to all you animal lovers out there that Burgess probably never actually did that to any dogs, but was just using those code words to avoid admitting that he had once disposed of human bodies. But around this time period, investigators uncovered evidence that Burgess had rented welding equipment in the days prior to Carrie's disappearance. Perry and another undercover FBI agent soon had a meeting with Burgess to discuss the disposal of Devin McGillicuddy. Since Carrie's body had still not been found after 2 decades, they both wanted assurances that McGillicuddy's body would be disposed of in the same place, and Burgess responded by stating, quote, "I will get rid of your puppy, and it will be within spitting distance." Now, the original plan was for Perry to deliver a sealed steel drum to Burgess, which supposedly contained McGillicuddy's body, and he would tell Burgess that he needed to get rid of it immediately. As extra motivation, Perry would also say that he had used a gun Burgess had sold him to commit the murder and welded it inside the drum alongside the body. Since Burgess's fingerprints were still on the weapon, he now would have a vested interest in ensuring the drum was never found. What Burgess wouldn't know is that the FBI had attached a transponder to the drum, so they were hoping that when Burgess went to dispose of it, he would unknowingly lead them to the same location where Carrie's remains were buried. Well, unfortunately, before this could take place, the FBI was forced to abandon their sting operation after Franklin Perry was arrested for running an unrelated Ponzi scheme on the side and sent back to jail. The FBI did not have the evidence to charge Burgess with anything in relation to Carrie's case, but at one point during their sting operation, Perry had arranged for Burgess to sell a .22 caliber handgun along with a silencer, rubber gloves, and ammunition to the undercover FBI agent he had been working with. As a result, Burgess was arrested on October the 11th, 2000, on the charge of being in possession of firearms and ammunition while a convicted felon. After being convicted of the offense at trial, Burgess would be sentenced to 11 and a half years in prison before he was released in 2013. When the Las Vegas Review-Journal published a 40th anniversary article about the case in October of 2018, reporters paid a visit to Burgess's home in Vegas, where he was still living with his wife, Phyllis. When they arrived, Burgess was sitting outside in a chair, getting a haircut from his wife. By this point, Burgess was 81 years old and using a walker, but Phyllis told the reporters to leave because they had nothing to say. At the time of this episode's recording, I believe Burgess is still alive, but he has not revealed any new information about Carrie's disappearance. When the Review-Journal attempted to speak to Saul Sage for this article, he declined to provide any comment, and they were unable to track down Marilyn Sage and her other 2 children. Unfortunately, after 4 decades, there are still no conclusive answers about what happened, and Carrie Sage continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I first became familiar with the Carrie Sage disappearance back when I was writing articles for listverse.com several years ago. During that time period, I researched a lot of unsolved cases involving ransom kidnappings, and many of them seemed to have a similar pattern. After the victim went missing, someone would call their family with a ransom demand, and one of 2 things would happen. The kidnapper would provide the family with instructions for a ransom drop, but no one would show up to collect the money, or, as in this particular case, the kidnapper would never contact the family again or provide any instructions for how to deliver the ransom. But either way, the frustrating common thread in all these cases is that the actual kidnapping victim was never found. You get the impression that the kidnapper got cold feet about the whole situation and decided to kill their victim and dispose of the body, even though they didn't receive any money, making this a truly senseless crime. In this particular case, the Sage family only received 1 call about Carrie's kidnapping and never even got the opportunity to pay the ransom, but the individual considered to be the prime suspect, Jerry Burgess, kept interjecting himself into the investigation and used the opportunity to extort money from multiple individuals. If Burgess was the perpetrator, perhaps he never had any intention to go through with the ransom drop, but instead orchestrated an elaborate con job to make as much money as possible with Carrie being nothing more than an innocent pawn. I think it's safe to say that the most famous ransom kidnapping of all time is probably the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, which occurred in March of 1932, when 20-month-old Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr., the son of world-famous aviator Charles Lindbergh, was abducted from his residence and held for ransom. The baby's skeletal remains were eventually found, and a suspect named Bruno Richard Hauptmann was charged, convicted, and executed for the crime, but the case is still steeped in controversy to this day. One of the most unusual aspects of that case was the intervention of a man named John Condon, whom the kidnappers authorized to function as their intermediary with Lindbergh. Condon wound up delivering the ransom money to a man believed to be Hauptmann, but the child was never returned, and until Hauptmann was arrested 2 years later, there was suspicion that Condon was personally involved in the kidnapping. In the end, nothing was ever found to indicate that Condon was complicit in the crime, but you get the impression that Jerry Burgess essentially decided to assign himself the John Condon role for this case. Now, the legal situation is unique, because Jerry Burgess has already been found not guilty of the kidnapping of Harry Sieg, so he cannot be charged with that crime again, but he has never been charged with Carrie's murder. Theoretically, if Carrie's remains were found, or new evidence surfaced to conclusively prove that Burgess committed a homicide, then yes, he could be charged, but given his advanced age, there isn't much time left for this to happen. If you're an Unsolved Mysteries fan, you're probably familiar with the story of Annie Herron, a wealthy socialite who was the victim of a ransom kidnapping in Mississippi in 1988. A suspect named Newton Alfred Wynn was eventually arrested because there was overwhelming evidence that he was responsible for Annie's abduction, and he received a 19-year prison sentence after being convicted of conspiracy to commit kidnapping, extortion, and perjury. However, because they could not recover Annie's body, and there was no concrete evidence of foul play, Wynn was never charged with her murder, even though it was pretty obvious that she was dead. And frustratingly, after Wynn served his sentence and was released from prison, he got to live the last few years of his life as a free man without revealing what happened to Annie. While Burgess was acquitted of Carrie's kidnapping, he did spend an ample amount of time in prison for other charges, but it's pretty much the same situation as with Newton Alfred Wynn, as Burgess is currently a free man and has no real motivation to come clean about what happened. Now, going back to the Lindbergh kidnapping case, even though Charles Lindbergh Sr. was one of the most famous people in the world at the time his child was abducted, he was most definitely not a saint, and if you read up on his life, you'll know that he held some very questionable views and did a number of questionable things. This has led to conspiracy theories that Lindbergh himself might have been complicit in his own son's disappearance and death, though they have never been substantiated. When Burgess went on trial, I can see why his defense team decided to direct suspicion towards Saul Sieg, as he was facing bribery charges at the time his son went missing, and they wound up being dismissed a few months later on compassionate grounds. However, while serving time in prison obviously would not have been an ideal situation for Saul, it's worth noting that his two associates from the bribery case, Jack Gordon and Joe Daly, were still convicted of these charges, but their sentences only wound up being 6 months. It definitely seems like a pretty major overreaction to stage your own son's kidnapping in order to garner sympathy and avoid what ultimately turned out to be a pretty minor stint in prison. However, while it pretty much seems to be a given that Burgess was involved in Carrie's kidnapping, the situation with Saul's legal troubles has led to speculation that there could have been multiple participants. Now, I will add a disclaimer that one frustrating aspect of researching this case is that I've occasionally come across conflicting information from different sources. I mentioned earlier that most of the sources state that the ransom amount was $500,000, and the FBI has claimed in recent years that it was actually $350,000, though I theorize that the FBI may have intentionally leaked an incorrect amount to the press in order to help them weed out false tips. But there are conflicting details about other aspects of this kidnapping. For instance, when Saul testified at Burgess's trial, he stated that he only met Burgess on one occasion prior to his son's kidnapping, and that's when Burgess stopped by his residence alongside his girlfriend and attempted to sell Saul some jewelry. Yet you'll find some sources out there which claim that Burgess was a former employee of Saul's, which I do not believe is accurate. And it's also been reported that Burgess supposedly offered to take care of Harry Reid in order to make Saul's bribery charges go away, which led to Saul kicking him out of his house. All this business with Harry Reid and the Nevada Gaming Commission is quite an interesting side story on its own. It seems like Saul's role in the bribery scandal has been downplayed, but one of Saul's associates, Jack Gordon, was a very sketchy character. When the FBI set up their sting operation in Reed's office and arrested Saul, Gordon, and Joe Daly for bribery, Reed actually yelled, quote, "You son of a bitch, you tried to bribe me," and attempted to strangle Gordon before the agents pulled him off. 3 years later, in 1981, Reed's wife found a bomb attached to the family station wagon, and while it was never determined who planted the device, Reed suspected it was Gordon. Gordon would later attain additional notoriety by becoming the manager for famous singer LaToya Jackson, who was eventually coerced into marrying him so that he could control virtually every aspect of her life. I could probably do an entire podcast episode about all the controversy surrounding Jack Gordon, but if you want to go down a major rabbit hole, just pull up his Wikipedia page. Saul Sage's lawyer, Oscar Goodman, was also a pretty interesting character in his own right, as he built up a reputation as the top mafia defense attorney in Las Vegas. Goodman represented a number of prominent organized crime figures, and he would even become mayor of Las Vegas from 1999 until 2011. One particularly famous Goodman client was Frank Lefty Rosenthal, who ran the Stardust Casino, and was the inspiration for Robert De Niro's character in the 1995 Martin Scorsese-directed film Casino. In fact, there's a scene in the movie where Goodman makes a cameo playing himself, where he represents De Niro's character at a Nevada Gaming Commission hearing while he chews out an unnamed senator. While the senator is not named in the film, he is clearly supposed to be Harry Reid, as the scene is based directly on a real-life incident where Lefty Rosenthal publicly called him out. So when you consider that Saul was associating himself with people like Jack Gordon and had Oscar Goodman as his defense attorney, you have to wonder if his son's kidnapping might somehow be linked to organized crime. One source I used for this episode was a book titled My Life in Crime, A Moderate Look at Crooks, written by a former probation officer named Will Kavanaugh, and it contains a chapter about the Kerry Sage case. I mentioned earlier how one source stated that Kerry was seen being forced into a Rolls Royce on the day he was kidnapped, and I got that piece of information from this book. But in no other source have I ever seen a specific description of the vehicle. But most interestingly, the book states that the 12-year-old student who witnessed Kerry's abduction had reported seeing four men in a Rolls Royce on the school grounds that day. I have not seen this detail about the four men shared anywhere else, but the book also says that when the student was called upon to testify at Jerry Burgess's kidnapping trial years later, he was specifically asked if Burgess was one of the four men in the Rolls Royce, and he replied no. Now, it's possible that the book's information is inaccurate, because you'd think that if Kerry had been kidnapped in a Rolls Royce, the vehicle's description would have been circulated everywhere in the original media coverage, yet I never saw it mentioned at all. And you'd also think it would have been easy to determine whether or not Burgess had access to a Rolls Royce on that date. But if the sighting of the four men on the school grounds is legitimate, then this would suggest that there were multiple people involved in Kerry's kidnapping, and Burgess wound up becoming the fall guy. Well, Will Kavanaugh's personal connection to this story is that when Burgess was later convicted on the federal charges of interstate theft and tax evasion, Kavanaugh was assigned to provide a pre-sentencing report for him. Kavanaugh says that when he went to visit Burgess in jail and told him how much prison time he would be facing, Burgess replied, quote, "Well, I'll be taken care of." And I'm now going to read the exact passage Kavanaugh wrote next, word for word. Quote, "I knew he meant that it would be by his reported employer, Al Calatro from Chicago, who had driven to Las Vegas despite bad health and sat through every day of the trial. There had been some speculation that the mob in Chicago had arranged the kidnapping so that Kerry's father wouldn't talk when he came to trial, but as with every other theory, this one was never proved." End quote. Well, it is true that Saul Sage was planning to go on trial on the bribery charges less than 2 months after Kerry was abducted, and I am intrigued by the idea that if he knew some incriminating information about the mob, holding his son hostage would provide him with incentive to keep his mouth shut. But my big issue with this theory is that if you do an internet search on Al Calatro, this so-called mob boss from Chicago, the only matches you'll get are literally the passages from Will Kavanaugh's book. I don't know if Kavanaugh got the name wrong, or it might have been misspelled, but I can't really share any thoughts on Al Kalatro's supposed involvement in this kidnapping if I can't actually find any evidence that Al Kalatro exists. I guess I can't rule out the possibility that Saul got himself in way over his head with his bribery scandal, and that his son's abduction was the result of his links to organized crime, but it's been over 40 years, and the only person who has ever been conclusively linked to the kidnapping is Jerry Burgess. We do know that Burgess could be placed on the grounds of the Albert Einstein Hebrew School around the time period Carrie went missing, though he claimed that he had an innocent explanation for being there since he was delivering lunch to his girlfriend's son. It is odd that we have inconsistent accounts from the student about whether or not Burgess was the man who forced Carrie into a vehicle, but we know that eyewitness testimony in criminal cases can be very fallible. But the fact that Burgess spent a lot of time on school grounds and did some work there as a handyman is very important, because he would have been familiar with the school's daily routine and known that Carrie would be out on the yard for lunchtime recess between 12 o'clock and 12:30 p.m. In fact, it was alleged that Burgess could have used this opportunity to befriend Carrie and gain his trust, which is how he managed to lure him into his car. Burgess's actions in the day following the kidnapping raised some major red flags, because for a guy who didn't even know the Sage family all that well, and had reportedly only met Saul on one previous occasion, he certainly wasted no time at inserting himself into the investigation. I think we can agree that Burgess's account of how he became the intermediary between the kidnappers and the family is one of the most absurd and ludicrous stories ever shared in a criminal case. According to Burgess, he's quote-unquote working the streets and quote-unquote spreading feeler money around when he just happens to pass by a ringing payphone which is answered by a stranger who yells out his name. And when Burgess gets on the phone, the kidnapper essentially tells him, "Well, we want you to be the go-between and communicate with the family on our behalf. Oh, and we also want you to use your own money to leave us a $25,000 down payment without even telling the family first." Uh-huh. I just cannot believe that Burgess would have the audacity to approach a grieving father who just lost his son and ask him to reimburse this money he supposedly used for a down payment without even providing any evidence to support his story. Even if Burgess had no actual involvement in the kidnapping, these actions paint him as a scummy con artist who exploited and preyed upon a kidnapped boy's family in order to profit. But let's look at the timeline for these events. The phone call to the Sage residence from the kidnapper took place 3 hours after Carrie was abducted and was answered by the neighbor, Geraldine Blutter, though it sounds like the caller might have mistakenly assumed she was Marilyn Sage. Blutter seemed pretty certain that Burgess was the caller and identified his voice during his trial, though we have to add the disclaimer that this was 3.5 years after the fact, so her memory was no longer fresh. That 40th anniversary article about the case I keep talking about from the Las Vegas Review-Journal said that a voice expert analyzed a recording of the call and found it probable that Burgess's voice and the voice of the caller was the same, but I am a bit confused about why a recording would even exist in the first place. It would be one thing if the Sages had already contacted the authorities about Carrie's kidnapping and were monitoring and recording all incoming calls to the residence, but at this particular point, no one was even aware that Carrie had been abducted yet. This was the only time the kidnapper ever made contact with anyone, so unless I'm missing something, I'm not sure why Blutter would be recording a seemingly routine phone call she picked up at her neighbor's residence. Regardless, since the kidnapper said he would be calling the Sages with instructions for how to deliver the ransom in 2 days, but never got back to them, it's interesting to monitor Burgess's known movements during this time period. The caller specifically ordered the Sages not to contact the police, but it's not entirely clear to me if they got in touch with the authorities immediately or after the 2-day window expired. But we know Burgess first approached Saul on the very same evening Carrie went missing, contacted him again the following morning to ask for reimbursement of the money he had been spreading around to obtain information about Carrie, and then phoned Saul the day after that with his story about getting in touch with the kidnapper while asking Saul to reimburse him for the down payment he gave. Burgess could have used these interactions to monitor if Saul had contacted the authorities, and decide whether it would be a feasible option to organize a ransom drop. Now, in many fiction films involving ransom kidnappings, such as the Mel Gibson thriller Ransom, you'll often see this criminal mastermind dream up some elaborate plan where they run the person delivering the ransom money around in circles to ensure that they are not being followed or tracked by the authorities. Well, in real life, most kidnappers are not that clever, so Burgess may have figured that if he organized a ransom drop with the Sags and they left the money at a specified location, there's a good chance the authorities would have been monitoring the situation and he would have been caught. The day when Burgess phoned Saul and asked to be reimbursed $32,000 was the same day the kidnapper was supposed to call, so you almost get the impression that Burgess had implemented a plan B. Even if Burgess couldn't collect a six-figure ransom, he could exploit the situation by extorting a decent amount of money out of Saul so he could still profit from the crime. You almost have to wonder if Burgess never intended on collecting any ransom and this was his plan all along. Remember, 2 years earlier, he had already pulled an elaborate con job by extorting $100,000 out of an elderly couple from Texas, so he definitely had experience at this sort of thing. And let's not forget that Burgess led investigators to one of Carrie's shoes, which was found in a remote area of the desert, after he supposedly received another phone call from the kidnappers informing him it would be there. Since Burgess was already on the radar as a potential suspect at this point, this may have been his attempt to divert suspicion away from himself, but it seems pretty obvious that he planted the shoe there himself and that phone call never happened. Sadly, if this whole kidnapping was intended as an elaborate con job to extort money from the Sags, Carrie was likely murdered a short time after he was abducted, and the idea that his body could have been welded inside a steel drum filled with acid before he was buried in the desert is truly horrific. If Burgess did it, you could assume that he killed Carrie because he panicked and realized that he had gotten himself in way over his head and decided that Carrie was a liability. However, Burgess supposedly rented welding equipment a few days before Carrie went missing, which seems to indicate that this crime was premeditated and he was always planning to kill the boy and dispose of his body in that fashion, no matter what happened. I wonder where the investigation might have led if Burgess had not been arrested on the sexual assault and interstate theft charges less than 2 months later. Burgess's arrest did make the news, and while all the information about the shoe and the extortion money was not public knowledge at that point, the papers did refer to Burgess as a quote-unquote material witness in Carrie's kidnapping. Details about Burgess's sexual assault on his girlfriend are very limited, but it's incredibly brazen that he picked up his girlfriend from her job at the Albert Einstein Hebrew School, drove her out into the desert and raped her, and then returned to the same school only 1 week later while his victim was working there in order to abduct Carrie. When she came forward, it sounds like the authorities had no issues believing her story, since Burgess got a 15-year prison sentence for the sexual assault. Now, I mentioned earlier that Will Kavanaugh was assigned to write the pre-sentence report when Burgess was convicted on the federal charges of interstate theft and tax evasion. The maximum sentence would have been 10 years on one count and 5 years on the other, but Kavanaugh recommended a sentence of 5 years total. However, Kavanaugh was taken by surprise when federal judge Harry Claiborne imposed the maximum sentence on each count for a total of 15 years and stated, quote, "I want you to know that you are being sentenced for what you have done, not what you are thought to have done," end quote. It's been theorized that even though Burgess had not yet been charged with anything in relation to Carrie Sags' kidnapping, Judge Claiborne personally believed that he was guilty of that crime and thought the appropriate response was to give him the maximum possible sentence on these other unrelated charges. Now, I am kind of torn about whether the jury made the right call when they decided to find Burgess not guilty at his kidnapping trial in 1982. On one hand, there was plenty of evidence to suggest he was guilty of the crime, but I can also understand them being thrown off by stuff like the former student testifying that Burgess was not the man he saw forcing Carrie into the vehicle. Burgess actually took the stand to testify on his own behalf, which is generally not recommended for defendants and can backfire in a huge way, but it seems the jury did feel he came across fairly believably while proclaiming his innocence. Burgess also made some very calculated moves during the trial, such as when he loudly yelled out in court that he had passed a polygraph. Obviously, the judge admonished Burgess for this, since polygraph results are inadmissible as evidence, but even though the judge could tell the jury to disregard that remark, it's not like they could just unhear it. Since the jury deliberated for 4 days, they obviously did not reach their decision lightly, but while you could defend their decision to acquit Burgess on the kidnapping charge, I am surprised they did the same thing on the separate charge of obtaining money under false pretenses, because he was clearly guilty of that offense. Remember, not only did he trick Saul Sage into reimbursing him a bunch of money for a down payment on the kidnapping, which was likely never made, but he convinced Hank Greenspun to hand over $154,000 for Carrie's safe return. Not only did Burgess not make good on his promise or return the money, but their conversation was recorded. So I'm really not sure why the jury acquitted Burgess on this charge, though it probably would have made much difference, since he still had to finish serving quite a few years in prison on other charges. Of course, getting a murder conviction without a victim's body was a lot more rare back in 1982, and there was no definitive proof that Carrie was even dead, so it was a wise decision to hold off on charging Burgess with murder. I guess the jury might have felt that since Burgess was going back to prison anyway, and he could be charged again if new evidence of foul play ever surfaced, why not err on the side of caution and reasonable doubt and find him not guilty of these charges? So the FBI sting operation to coerce Burgess into leading them to the location of Carrie's remains is quite a fascinating saga, which involved a lot of work, and it's a shame it didn't pan out. I particularly love the detail of how an FBI agent literally posed as a dead body named Devin McGillicuddy for a photograph in hopes that Burgess could be convinced to dispose of it in the same spot where Carrie was buried. While some of these conversations with Burgess were secretly recorded, it sounds like he never flat out admitted on tape that he killed Carrie because he was using code words like puppy and Rottweilers to describe the dead bodies he had disposed of. This is where the whole scenario about welding a body inside a steel drum filled with acid came into play, but I do have to acknowledge that since Burgess was hoping to get paid $250,000 to dispose of this one body, he could have been lying or greatly exaggerating his abilities to make bodies disappear. However, there is a record of Burgess having rented welding equipment shortly before Carrie went missing. Since Las Vegas is surrounded by desert, and there is no shortage of places to get rid of a body, it's too bad that this FBI informant, Franklin Perry, was arrested on unrelated charges before Burgess could lead anyone to the area where Carrie might be. However, if this plan had worked out, and Carrie's remains were recovered, and Burgess was charged with his murder, this sting operation probably would have been featured on true crime shows and podcasts until the end of time. As it is, Burgess still wound up spending over 11 years in prison for the relatively minor crime of possessing firearms while a convicted felon, but I'm sure the FBI was more than happy to throw the book at him. But unfortunately, it did not compel Burgess to reveal any new information about Carrie's case, and he has since served his time and been released while the investigation has reached a standstill again. Since Burgess obviously doesn't have much time left, I think the authorities are banking on the possibility that he'll develop a conscience and finally reveal the location of Carrie's remains before he passes away. You can definitely make some parallels between this story and the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, because the consensus in that case is that even if Bruno Richard Hauptmann was guilty of the crime all along, he did not act alone, and there were other people involved in his plan who got away with it. But at least with the Lindbergh baby, his remains were actually found. I guess it's possible that there were others involved in Carrie's kidnapping, but here we are 4 decades later, and no direct evidence has ever pointed to anyone else. As far as I can tell, all the evidence still points to Jerry Burgess being the sole perpetrator. It sounds like this crime completely devastated the Sage family, and even though Carrie had an older brother and sister, and I have never seen them give interviews to the media, and I have no idea what they might be up to today. But since they are a Jewish family, it is still extremely important for them to recover Carrie's remains someday, because in Jewish tradition, it is believed that the soul cannot start its journey back to God until the body is laid to rest. We may never see proper justice in this case, but at the very least, this missing boy can be found and given a proper burial. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Carrie Sigg, please contact the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department at 702-795-3111. That's 702-795-3111. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a special bonus episode about the unsolved disappearance of Mel Wiley, a police chief who vanished from Hinckley Township, Ohio, in 1985. In addition, we've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself, Jules, and our other co-host, Ashley, discuss the unsolved 2004 murder of Sarah Fox. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Melissa W., S.S. Toga, Lisa M., Nikolai F., Sammy S., Jeffrey B., and Chelsea G. Thank you all so much for your support. Now, the reminder that provided that it is safe enough to travel there, I'm hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and 12th. If you would like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COLD22. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is COLD22. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvogel.com. That's getvokl.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, just a few days after this episode's release, I will finally be on Podcast Row at CrimeCon in Las Vegas, which will make this the first time I have traveled out of Canada in order to attend a podcasting event since the pandemic began. I have a feeling that some of you listeners will also be attending, and if so, feel free to come say hi and meet me at my table. So everyone, have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.